The Local Thread.
Welcome to Toledo Works, a weekly show produced in partnership with the Toledo Free Press as a part of WGTE's The Local Thread. I'm Jaden Jefferson, a politics and government writer and podcast host for the Free Press. The theme of this episode is nonprofits. In 2025, they grappled with the challenge posed by the pausing or complete elimination of their federal funding, even as the need in their communities continued to grow. Now, in 2026, we're checking in with a few Toledo nonprofits to first understand who they serve and how, then get a sense of where they're at currently, and gain a fuller picture of their respective cause. My first guest is Aline Meyer, CEO of the Center for Community Impact, a for-profit that helps nonprofits. Welcome to Toledo Works.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd just like to first start out with, what is the Center for Community Impact, and how did you get involved as its CEO?
So the Center for Community Impact, I founded in 2023 with the mission to help nonprofit organizations scale their mission. I've been a practitioner in the social sector for 25 years, have served a number of nonprofit organizations in Northwest Ohio, and have found the same barriers existed in all the organizations I've served and similarly with the colleagues that I worked with. And about 10 years ago, I was exposed to the concept of the overhead myth and became a student of studying what the overhead myth meant and wanted to take what I had learned and bring it to the entire sector to help us overcome some of the most common barriers that hold back organizations from sustainability and scaling their mission.
And you mentioned barriers. Could you speak to some of those barriers? What are some of the challenges that nonprofits face?
So the essence of the overhead myth is that nonprofit organizations should keep their overhead low, their operating expenses, salary, marketing costs, fundraising costs. And really, the opposite is true. Nonprofit organizations are businesses. Nonprofit is just simply a tax identification. 501c3 is how you file with the IRS, but that is not an organization's identity. Nonprofits are businesses just like for-profits are businesses.
Right.
And as such, they need to follow many of the same business practices, investing in marketing so that they can scale their awareness, investing in fundraising so that they can raise more dollars to execute the initiatives that support their mission. Salary is a big concern. 41% of the individuals who are employed by nonprofit organizations do not make a living wage today.
Wow.
There's a huge disparity between the pay scale for nonprofit employees and for-profit employees. And it really speaks to the sustainability of our sector. It holds back the sector from recruiting individuals who are highly talented, but could earn more money going elsewhere. And so we lose that talent to the sector. And it really speaks to our retention issue. There is a huge retention issue within the social sector, and that causes all kinds of systemic issues for an organization.
And so what are some of the things that nonprofits have to do to adapt and to really combat the fact that the private sector is attracting so many employees?
Well, pay less is, you know, one of the most common strategies, and we really lack with benefits. There's a staggering rate of nonprofit organizations that do not offer healthcare benefits. And what we find is that those that want to get into this field of work have to get a second job to secure healthcare benefits or to fund the gap in their salary so that they can provide for their family adequately.
And obviously, if they have to pick up a second job, they're not able to dedicate their full attention to the work of a nonprofit.
Yeah. And this is more common than you think. The Center for Community Impact, I consult now. I'm an impact strategist and work with a number of agencies to help them to understand how they can build their business acumen and diversify their revenue streams to become more sustainable. And almost all of my clients have employees that have second jobs and have executive directors that have second jobs. And it does certainly impact the amount of time and mental bandwidth they have to focus on the mission.
And obviously, a lot of people, they go into nonprofit work hoping to make a positive difference, but oftentimes things play out a lot differently. And so what are some of the mistakes that people who start a nonprofit make as newcomers to the area?
We talk a lot about the true cost of business and understanding what the full cost is and building your budget accordingly. When we talk about the overhead myth, one of the things we touch on is the scarcity mindset and the martyrdom. So really unlike entrepreneurs who start out a business, a lot of times we will forsake our salary, forsake our compensation in order to be able to afford the other line items of a budget. And that truly is a mistake because it's really hard to catch up once you start playing that game. So having a real true sense of what the cost is and not looking at it through the lens of frugality. If a mission is something that you really care about and it's a difference that really needs to be made in this community, you want to put the most towards it, not the least.
And one thing I read about the Center for Community Impact is that you also have clients and you work with those clients. So kind of speak to me about those relationships that you've developed and some of the ways that you work with them to help them achieve those goals that they would like to.
Each of the relationships I have with my clients are highly personalized.
Of course.
I love to really understand the full scope of the mission, get to understand the team. I have a master's in organizational development, so it's very fascinating and helpful to me to understand how the organization is structured. So we will take a look at the institutional readiness for the initiatives they're looking to launch and then help them prepare to become better stabilized in order to move forward with those projects, whether it's a funding initiative or a new project that they want to add to their program repertoire. It really varies. I really enjoy the strategy work. I really enjoy working with board of directors. There's so many good-hearted, well-intended people who sit in a boardroom and don't fully understand their responsibility as a board member. And so board training is really, really important. It starts with the board, starts with your leadership. And so we spend a lot of time making sure that board members understand the mission, they understand the scope of their responsibility in being a steward of the organization.
And what you're speaking to there is this disconnect, because that's something even as I was preparing for this interview, I wanted to get your take on, because especially in the Toledo area, there's no shortage of nonprofits, but oftentimes it's kind of difficult to see what results are stemming from some of the work that they're doing. And so how do you go about approaching that disconnect that exists between nonprofits and the individuals they're supposed to be serving?
That is one area that I think as a sector, we just are not that great at. We do not toot our own horn, and we aren't always intentional about collecting the information that helps tell the impact story. And so with my clients, we talk about what is the goal. We have a logic model that spells out what it is we're going to try to accomplish, the methods in which we're going to do that, how we're going to measure success, and then most importantly, how we're going to communicate that. Because the only way to get more support is to be able to show the progress and show the growth. And scaling impact is what we're all about. And so we have to be able to communicate it.
And certainly when applying for grants, that's a huge part of that process, is showing the work that your organization is already doing.
Right. Grantors want to see outcomes and want to feel good about the investment they've made.
What would you say are some of the biggest challenges just facing nonprofits right now? I know I mentioned in the intro, federal funding is not as reliable as it once was. And so in the diversification process, what are you noticing about how nonprofits are adapting, particularly during this time?
I think having lack of diversification in funding streams is one thing that does hurt organizations. I work with a number of agencies right now who have social enterprises and have created a market and are selling a product or a program to help subsidize the operations of their mission. It's a huge undertaking to have a social enterprise, and it's fairly new to the sector. There's best practices that are still developing around how you run a business to support your mission. But then even just applying strategy to the things you already know and doing them better, sometimes it's a greater outcome to do fewer things well than to spread yourself thin.
And we often see companies do this, where companies will decide to get into the world of philanthropy. And part of it, of course, is image. But at the same time, there are some genuine desires to do good in the world. But again, you have that disconnect, and maybe things aren't as run as efficiently as they should be. And so what do you think about the idea of companies maybe reforming how they approach giving and doing good in their communities?
We talk a lot about corporate social responsibility at the Center for Community Impact, and with the corporate partners that we coach, we help them understand what corporate social responsibility looks like and to approach it from an authentic way as to think about what's really important to them and their business and their bottom line. And we talk about that triple bottom line. How are you supporting the environment and your organization and the cause that you care about? And to be intentional in creating the opportunity to support that cause in a way that is authentic and also helps you meet your business goals.
And in the time that you've been doing this work, would you say that companies are starting to learn the importance of authenticity, or is it still something that's hard to come by?
I want to believe that it's common sense, you know, but this is not businesses' forte. It's not their specialty.
And, that's right, they're so, businesses, yeah.
You know, and the work of fundraising has only really been professionalized for maybe the last 20 years. Before that, when I started out in this work, there weren't masters of fund development. There wasn't the Lilly School of Philanthropy. And so we still have, I believe, a little bit of catching up to do in the business world to recognize that this is a profession, that there is some art to it, but there is also a lot of science. And so recognizing that and not being afraid to ask for help to shape the process and the programs that you have to in mind to achieve your goals.
Yeah, and how do you go about the process of having a company that says, okay, we want to start doing philanthropic work in our community, we just don't know what to do or how to do it? How do you start in that process?
I think it starts with looking at your mission, your core values, maybe what's important to your employees, finding out what really resonates. And that may be driven from a bottom line that can be made better through a cause-related project, or it might be rallying support behind an employee who went through a mental catastrophe. I think it's understanding your why first, because if you don't really have a solid why, you're not going to have buy-in for the long term.
And certainly people who are working in nonprofits, they have a lot of passion for what they do. But at the same time, that passion can maybe overwhelm the business aspects because they don't view themselves as working for a business. And so is that something that's hard for them to overcome, especially when there's so much passion, but at the same time, bottom lines that have to be paid attention to?
Yeah. I think that sometimes we're so passionate that we forget to listen.
Yeah.
And so it's really important to listen to what the business's goals are, to help them clarify them. If it's not clear for them, if they just know they want to do something good in the community, but they're not really sure how, that's where a nonprofit organization can show them. But it's important to make sure that you align and that it's something that is a win-win partnership and that you can both feel good about at the end of the day, and that it furthers the impact for both the business and the nonprofit organization.
Yeah. And one thing I want to ask you about, we saw in 2020 that there were some companies that really leaned into the idea of having social responsibility. And for some, it was more authentic than it was for others. But in the time since, have you seen some companies actually turn around and maybe do the work that they should, or have some really just kind of let that work fall to the wayside?
Yeah, I think for those that weren't authentic about why they were in corporate social responsibility plans, they've fallen away. I mean, when you look at the pushback that has happened because of DEI, a lot of those corporate social responsibility programs came about because DEI was hot and it was something that we should do because we should do it. And then when it fell under criticism, those corporate social responsibility plans just kind of fell by the wayside because it was no longer popular.
And what do you think are going to be the consequences of that? The fact that some companies stated that their objectives were to do work that was impactful and now not actually follow through. What are going to be the impacts for those communities that trusted them?
There's a gap, you know, one that now those organizations are looking to fill. And I think for the companies, it requires them to regain the trust.
And that's not easy to do.
No, it's not. But I think we've, as a society, are becoming more and more questioning and fact-finding. And so just as nonprofit organizations need to be transparent and intentional with communicating their impact, that's not any different for a business.
Right. It's constantly a process of learning and growing. And looking at just the nonprofits that stand alone by themselves, what are some of the different ways that they're approaching fundraising and communicating their mission? Because as we mentioned, it's not an easy thing for them to do. It's not something that comes natural.
So obviously social media is a huge opportunity.
For sure.
And it's constantly evolving. And some of the most effective fundraising strategies I've seen are peer-to-peer campaigns, beneficiaries of the organization who are telling their personal stories, and their circle of influences are hearing about it from them, not the organization. And so that authentic connection is made that wasn't driven by a marketing plan or a paid fundraising professional. And those organizations are engaging supporters and interest more authentically.
And lastly here, just looking at the Center for Community Impact and its future, where do you hope to take it in terms of helping out more and more nonprofits and also guiding them through philanthropy? Because it's something that isn't easy.
We have really focused on helping to write a new narrative, a new story about the importance of overhead. Last year, the Center for Community Impact was named as a pilot community with a national movement called Five and Rising. Five and Rising represents 5.2% of the GDP, which is what the social sector currently contributes.
Wow.
It's huge. The social sector is not recognized for its contributions to the economy. We have 10% employment rate that's larger than the construction or the hospitality industry. And so our work right now is focused on helping the sector understand the contributions it makes, both economically and just in terms of changing the community issues that we have, and that they truly have the capacity to do more if we can engage a community in investing fully in their needs.
So in other words, there is a return on investing. When you give money toward a nonprofit, you do see that money come back in certain ways in your community.
Yeah. And we like to say within our advisory board, you get what you pay for, which is usually seen as a negative connotation. And we're really flipping that on its head. You get what you pay for. And if we fully invest in the things that we care about, imagine what we could get.
Imagine indeed. Well, Aline Meyer, CEO of the Center for Community Impact, thanks so much for being our first guest on this edition of Toledo Works. Toledo Works continues after this. You're listening to Toledo Works from the Toledo Free Press and WGTE Public Media. I'm Jaden Jefferson. Joining me now is Tanya Scherf, who is the Executive Director of Food for Thought. Tanya, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to first start, for those unfamiliar with Food for Thought, what is some of the work that your organization does in the community, and how did you get involved?
So Food for Thought has been around for nearly 20 years now. We started very simply handing out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches downtown Toledo in 2007, and that turned into a full-scale lunch offering and hot coffee. The most important thing about this distribution is that we create a safe space and community for people who need it. So we're serving 250 bagged lunches every single Saturday morning. And when I say every Saturday, I mean every single Saturday, no matter the weather, the holiday, we are down there serving people in need. And a few years after that started, we launched into a mobile food pantry program because we discovered that the need for food existed outside of downtown Toledo. It existed in a lot of other areas. So we pack up carts of food on our trailer, and we have pantry partners throughout the city, and we unload groceries and serve anyone who wants to, who's in need or wants to shop with us. But although there's a lot of food pantries in the area, a couple things that make Food for Thought different is that we don't ask people to qualify. So we serve anyone that comes to our food pantry with a photo ID. A lot of families we're serving now actually don't qualify for the SNAP program. They're making just a little too much to get assistance, but they're still struggling to keep up with the rising cost of everything. So that is really what drew me to Food for Thought. I've been doing nonprofit work for 25 plus years, but my parents divorced when I was a teenager, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom at the time. And so her getting a job and trying to keep us in a good school district, every month it was less and less assistance that we were getting. And we could have really used a place like Food for Thought that didn't have any questions, that just let us come in and pick the groceries we needed. So that's what I think drew me to Food for Thought more than anything.
And you make an important point there, which is that this is a public policy issue as well, because there are some people who simply are not covered by the social safety net, and it's been this gap that exists. And at the same time, this is a country with a $30 trillion gross domestic product, GDP, there are people every day who still go to bed without a full meal.
Yeah.
And so what do you make of that? And what are some of the things that you would like to see change, whether legislatively or policy-wise?
So I don't think we have enough time to cover everything I'd like to see change.
Certainly.
But yeah, you're exactly right. So there are a lot of people in need, and there are a lot of programs available. However, as you pointed out, there's this gap that exists between people that can get resources and those that can't, and then those that can afford, the rising cost of groceries. So those are the people that we focus on the most. And I don't mean that to sound that we don't focus on everyone, but we know there are very few resources that exist for that pocket of people. So we're really proud to say that we want everyone to come in, and we want to serve everyone with dignity and respect. And we don't want anyone to feel ashamed. We've all been in different areas of need in our life. So I would like to see there be, some type of rolling off process. Or step down, to assistance. Everyone has a different income, therefore needs different programs and assistance. And food is just everyone has the right to eat and eat well.
Right.
And that's something that we would love to work with, activists and lawmakers to try to get that to change to where they help people who don't qualify for the full, assistance package from the government.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that that's maybe the biggest challenge or the biggest hurdle for an organization like yours is that the fact that some people just do not view food as a human right or as a necessity for so many?
Yes. I think that there are there's a lot of stigma around food pantries and the people in need. For example, a lot of people that we serve downtown Toledo, that are unhoused, everyone thinks that it's because they're on drugs. They're on drugs, they're alcoholics, it's their fault. Now, I've met plenty of people that are there because of those circumstances. I've even met people that don't want to get off the street. That's what they're comfortable with. It's where they've been for years. And if that's what they want, then that's fine. But there are more families I've met that become homeless because of one catastrophic event.
Right.
Whether that is the loss of a job. I actually met a family a couple of years after I started Food for Thought. A gentleman would come down on Saturdays by himself and pick up a few lunches. He said he had some kids. Eventually, he started bringing the kids with him a few Saturdays in. And I guess, got comfortable talking with us and shared that his wife had been diagnosed with leukemia. He eventually lost his job from taking off so much time to care for her, and the kids were young. So it was, first we got rid of cable, then we got rid of our cell phones, then we got rid of this and that, and eventually he lost his job. And they were living in their van. And it was just, as a mother, oh, it was just heartbreaking to think that, you know, how many of us are a paycheck or two away from being in that same exact situation if something happens, whether, you know, it's an illness, a loss of a job, caring for someone else in your family because of that. So when I tell people that and I ask them to think about how long they could last if they didn't have supports, you know, no grandparents, aunts, uncles, people that could come to their rescue, how long could you make it on what you have? And you really see people start to think like, ooh, maybe not so long, you know? So, yeah, it's, I think there's a real stigma and a real misunderstanding about what causes people to be in their situation.
And it's really difficult to understand why so many people feel so disconnected from those stories, because mm-hmm. every person I know is at least one paycheck closer to ending up in significantly more difficult circumstances yep. than they are from, say, hitting it big, quote unquote.
Oh, yeah.
And so do you think that that's a big part of it, is that people maybe have a pride about themselves that they assume they never will need support?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I mean, we all think it won't be us. It's just like when your parents tell you to drive carefully or, you know, don't get in cars with strangers, you know, it's because, oh, it'll never happen to me. And everyone feels that way about, I think, you know, becoming homeless or being in a situation where you have to ask for help. You know, it won't be me. And what we don't know just makes us uncomfortable. And I've learned that throughout my years of this work. If you're unfamiliar with something, you shy away from it, and it just makes you uncomfortable, so you don't want to know. And that just, you know, it just adds to the, you know, the ignorance of certain situations. So,
and that's kind of the dark underbelly of this country, is that the majority of people have to work paycheck to paycheck mm-hmm. in order to meet basic needs. And it hasn't always been that way.
No, not at all. You know, we've had years where gas has been high, and then there's some years it's energy that's high,
right.
and some years it's water. But since 2022, everything has risen and stayed there. And that's, I say that because that's been our biggest jump, not even during COVID. Everyone was giving out food during COVID, which was wonderful. It was needed. But we saw our biggest jump from 2022 to 2023, and it was directly related to the increase in everything, just day-to-day living, medicine, everything. We started serving. In 1 year, we jumped up almost 40%.
Wow.
In the number of people we serve. So our 10 mobile food pantries right now serves almost 900 families a month in just the Lucas County area. So it's the need is great, and I think greater than people think right in their own backyard.
And you had made a great point earlier in that the need exists outside of just downtown Toledo, mm-hmm. where Food for Thought started. The need is in many other communities in Lucas County. And so what has that process been like in meeting those communities and getting to know them and, of course, serving them with the resources that you have as an organization?
Yeah, that's honestly, that's been a little more challenging than I would have thought. And I think it goes back to I don't think there's need here, you know. So I have to run the statistics for them and take it to them and say, look, according to what I know about, let's say, South Toledo, Maumee area, you would think there wouldn't be a big need, because usually when people think need, they're thinking, okay, 75% of people living under the poverty line and whatever. But the group of people that are living in this area are living paycheck to paycheck. So we can serve the community together if we can set up a food pantry that has no restrictions, where anyone can come in and get service. And so we strategically place our food pantries around the area so we can hit those outlying areas, Holland, East Toledo, Oregon, South Toledo, North Toledo, West End, you know, so we're purposeful in that, so that way our reach is wide, because we know it exists out there. We know it's there. So
yeah, the data tells a story. Mm-hmm. And what is typically the reaction that you get from individuals who otherwise wouldn't interact with Food for Thought? Are they oftentimes surprised by the fact that they're having an interaction with your organization, or have they never expected to?
As a patron, as someone who needs food, do
yeah.
you mean? Yes. Yeah, you can tell those people. as soon as they walk in the door, they're very hesitant, trepidation. They're not sure how to navigate this system. And, you know, another thing about Food for Thought, and I know this from going to, you know, other food pantries over the years, we really take our time to get to know the people that come to us because we don't want anyone to feel ashamed. It's hard enough to reach out for help. You shouldn't be ashamed to come in and pick up some groceries for your family, you know, and it's the stories that we've heard over the years and the people that are just so grateful for us being there is why we keep doing what we do. I mean, we know it's always going to be a need, unfortunately. So while we're happy to see that we're serving more people, on the other hand, I'm sad that I'm serving more people because we don't want there to be that need. We want to go out of business. So that way there isn't this need for food, that everyone has access and can afford it. So,
and you mentioned that need has only continued to grow. Do mm-hmm. you ever see that plateauing, or is this the expectation that things are going to get worse?
I don't see it going away, unfortunately. I really don't. In the 25 years I've been in this line of work and the need that's out there, and not just with food and insecurity. I've worked for disease-specific organizations, but you know, as long as people are suffering in whatever way it is, there are going to be organizations that want to do more for that, you know, whatever that is. And as long as things keep rising and the cost of living keeps going up and we stay in this somehow bubble that has been created, there's going to be this problem around food and the access, you know, and it's specifically to fresh food. You know, that's another thing that's very important to Food for Thought, is not just canned foods, you know, that we can get and we're grateful for, but fresh produce and healthy produce and produce that we would choose for our own families. You know, the rule, and my staff and volunteers will tell you, if you wouldn't pick it for yourself, do not put it on the pantry. Do not let it go out the door, because we want to be proud of what we're serving people. Someone in need doesn't deserve to get secondhand or picked over or leftovers. They deserve to be able to pick fresh food that you would take for your family. So, you know, we're very committed to making sure we have frozen protein, frozen meat, dairy products, gallon milk, eggs, butter, cheese, and, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. So,
and I certainly think that that's something we should spend more time on, because I think one thing people don't realize, given where they're located or where their neighborhood is, if you live close to a grocery store, you're privileged in that sense, because a lot of people live in food deserts, and exactly. The food that is accessible is food that is cheap, food that is not good for the body. And so, what is the role of that challenge in just addressing food insecurity, the fact that some people just simply aren't able to access healthy, fresh food?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest barriers is transportation, you know, getting to. It's funny because even this afternoon when I stopped for gas, I was waiting for a receipt that wouldn't come out at the pump. And I looked over and there was this really sad little fruit stand, and it had two peaches in it. I don't know how long they'd been there. And it had six bananas. Two were still very green and the others really needed to be thrown away yesterday. And I thought, these are the choices that people that can't get to a full grocery store, this is their choice. And it's no wonder that we're staying ill and sick, because we don't have access to fresh food and people are too far from a full grocery store. And so that's another one of the points, you know, when we're looking for spaces to be, is, are we more than a mile from a full grocery store so we can bridge that gap? And are we on a bus line so that people can take the bus to us and get to us and get back home?
Yeah, and that's just so concerning, because people do want healthy food. They want food that they can feed their family and be glad that they're feeding their family that food, but in many cases simply can't access it. So do you feel like Food for Thought is kind of filling that gap, even though it's certainly a large gap?
Yeah, I really do. I really do feel that we're doing a good job filling that gap, because we are so intentional about where we serve and where we start our food pantry locations, and then also the food that we serve. I think that it's, you know, we really are paying attention to what people want. We do surveys every other year of the people that visit us, anonymous surveys, so they can let us know what is important to them and what, so that way we're not telling them what they need. They're telling us, you know, so we can continue to meet the need of what people want. Yeah.
And that's not something that exists with every nonprofit. In some cases, the approach is essentially, for lack of a better word to put it, just accept what we offer and ask no questions about it. Not every nonprofit does the work to actually explore what specifically the need is. And so is that something that you would say is different with Food for Thought, is that there's an actual assessment of what the need is before trying to solve it?
Yeah. I don't want to say that other nonprofits don't do their due diligence and do good work, because, you know, every nonprofit exists for a reason. I want us to be able to complement other food pantries, if that makes sense, not compete. There's no reason we should all be offering the same thing. So that was the reason why we started doing the surveys, was what are we missing? Is there something people want that we're not picking up on? You know, and over again, it's thank you for the fresh produce. Thank you for the variety that we're getting. Thank you for the gallon milk instead of the powdered milk or the shelf-stable milk, you know, and for the shredded cheese and you know, different things. So I think it's important that we're paying attention to what the need is out there, but then we're communicating with one another and making sure that we're not duplicating services, because the need is so great. So why don't we all do something a little different and then be able to, you know, complete the need as much as possible.
Right. And looking at what the needs have been, what are some of the lessons that you've learned as executive director that you're hoping to take with you into this new year?
You know, really, patience. You know, things take time. You know, good work takes time, especially if you want to do it correctly. And that's not always been a strong suit of mine. But also just, I think, gratefulness that we have such a great community. You know, really, Toledo is a wonderfully giving community. There are so many fantastic philanthropic, you know, companies in this town that are really stepping up to volunteer, to really get out there and see what the need is, and not just write a check towards it, but to actually come and volunteer and meet the people that we serve and see firsthand their dollars at work. You know, so I'm so grateful for the community in stepping up to all of these challenges that we have. I really couldn't ask for a better place to be right now, given the circumstances, because we're pretty fortunate here in Toledo.
Certainly. Well, Tanya Scherf is the executive director of Food for Thought. Tanya, thanks again for coming on the show. And coming up next, we're going to be talking urban agriculture with Urban Holistics. I'm Jaden Jefferson. You're listening to Toledo Works. Welcome back to Toledo Works here on FM 91. I'm Jaden Jefferson. Our final guest on this week's episode is Bridget Adams, an agricultural teacher with Urban Holistics. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Just first explain for individuals who may not have encountered Urban Holistics' work, what this group, this organization does and the impact that it has.
Urban Holistics was started in 2019 by my boss, Sonia Flunder McNair, who saw a lot of open land in the Junction neighborhood specifically, which is where she started the programming. She started an urban farm. She has since built it into something absolutely amazing. And now to go along with it, there is youth programming, there's families, there are seniors that are being helped by the organization.
And kind of speak to some of the different programs that are offered by Urban Holistics.
So starting with just an open lot, and now we've got a full farm there. There are chickens, there are bees, there's lots of food being grown year-round. They've got a hoop house. So what we're doing is teaching young people to farm in the city, because that's a real need we have, teaching people to cook their fresh produce, maybe introduce them to foods that are new to them, which they then bring home to their families and their communities. So we're helping economic development in the neighborhood. We're helping with green space development in the neighborhood. And my job is really working with the youth in different youth programs, helping them learn to be healthy and do it in a sustainable way so that they can self-sustain it.
Yeah, and that first skill of just being healthy, it's certainly something that isn't easy, especially given that so many parts of the city of Toledo are a part of a food desert. And so there isn't that easy access to healthy food. And so what's the value in really teaching those skills so these students have the ability to grow food on their own?
Yeah, it was something that we talked about in my class, actually. I teach middle school right now, and we talked about food equity, food deserts, even food slums, and how they came about, how these problems started in our communities and what we can do to fix it. So we actually had a project where the students sat down and dealt with the problem of food deserts and helped solve those problems in their own way. So we had some kids who had a grocery store on wheels and some kids whose idea it was to open pop-ups in their community. They even had their corners picked out. They had ideas for volunteers and ideas for funding too.
It would seem as if the kids are more innovative than the approach of adults to this problem.
It's really amazing. And I think that most teachers will tell you, you learn more than you teach usually. So I love to give them that creative license and let them really think about a problem and then solve it on their own, come up with their own solutions.
And what would you say is the response that students often have to your lessons? Because that's just one of them. What are some of the different things that are on their minds as they're going through the day?
I find that when you feed kids, they like you. So so what we do is we introduce them with gardening. We teach them about soil and compost. And it's not just dirt. We've got millions of things living in this soil.
Right.
We talk about the challenges of growing in the city, but also the benefits of growing in the city, that you can just walk down the street to your farm. We talk about ways to feed themselves and their families. And then we get to cook, which is, I think, sometimes their favorite part. They get to go outside, they get to harvest, they get to garden, and then they get to cook and eat what they've made and bring it home, bring it to their friends, bring it to their families. So that's, I think, the most exciting part for them. So we're teaching not just agriculture, but also food prep, wellness, and nutrition.
What would you say is the importance of showcasing that farm-to-table process?
I think children especially aren't naturally inclined to go eat every color of vegetable. They may not have access to it. They may not have grown up eating all of these different things. And I think having kids myself, I'm a mom, just exposure to all of these different healthy foods and availability, of course, is going to help. Teaching them that this funny looking squash can be made into something really amazing that then they're excited to share with others.
And there really is this connection that we've lost over the years between the farm, the food, where we got our food, and where it actually, you know, we buy it from. Because over time, we've seen heavy industry be a big part of how we get our food in our food chain. And so there is that disconnect between the farm and how we eat it at home. And so there kind of is this restoration happening of that connection between, oh, this is where my food comes from. It doesn't start at the grocery store.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to see a child dig a potato out of the ground and make something with it that doesn't resemble McDonald's French fries, but is equally as delicious and probably healthier.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the kids are really attracted to the idea of cooking their own food. And that's certainly a skill that a lot of kids can use, and just even adults as well. And so what's the importance there?
I feel like as soon as children get their hands on something, they're much more comfortable with it and they're much more willing to take a chance. So even though I'm thinking of one week where we had a surplus of delicata squash, which is a wonderful squash if you get a chance. It's kind of funny looking and striped, but it's tender and you can eat the skin on it. And it's really sweet and delicious. So at first we had these weird looking squash that nobody had ever seen. I don't think I've ever cooked them before either. We made a wonderful vinaigrette. We roasted the squash in the classroom with equipment we bring in. And they were all eating it and sharing it with all of their friends afterward. I then had four more requests to join the class because everybody liked the food so much. So it's a great recruitment tool too.
Yeah, and looking at the question of affordability, certainly a lot of people are running into that challenge not only this year, but have for some time. And so what is the gap that's being filled by Urban Holistics programming, especially when a lot of people are struggling to purchase food?
Yes. Snap It Forward was a kind of a mini program, or an initiative, I should say. Snap It Forward was an initiative that we've been working on during the harvest season this year, right before the hard frost. So we had farms that had surplus. They needed to get it to people as quickly as they could. So Sonia actually put together several teams of volunteers to go out in the field at Shared Legacy Farms and harvest. So my students went out there with a great big truck, harvested thousands of pounds of squash and other veggies. And then they actually got to be at our urban farm handing out big bags of produce to seniors, families, all sorts of people who needed food on the table. It was right when SNAP was in jeopardy. So that was one of my favorite days, was watching my students who had just harvested then distribute that food. They even talked to people about how to cook it because some of it was new to them. And I thought that was great.
Yeah. And we were were just having the conversation before we started rolling, which was that we have so much food available in this country, essentially a breadbasket. But what often happens is that that chain is broken between farmers and people who desperately need the food. And so what do you make of the relationship that has been cultivated with local farmers?
I think it's wonderful. Local farmers are very giving people. They want to help. They want to be there for people. They want to feed people. And I think it's wonderful that we were able to coordinate a way to get food into people's cars. It was actually a drive up that we did. So they didn't even have to get out and get muddy. It was a rainy day. So it's really wonderful that we were able to facilitate it, that the students were able to see it and be a part of it. And I loved how they felt about themselves later. We counted 333 distributions. So 333 tables that had food on them for about a week or two because of what they did. And they were super proud.
And that relationship, it just goes to show that relationships can be so effective in resolving a lot of the problems that we see and the challenges that people face in our community. And of course, being a teacher, you get to see each day how these students are making new discoveries and, you know, being enlightened by the experience. And so how does that feel for you personally?
It's thrilling to me. I've always been interested in feeding people. I'm a cook and I'm a mom and I'm a teacher. So I really, really like to share that with people. If you come into my house, you're going to get fed and I'll probably send you home with food. So that's my passion. When I met Sonia, I was so in love with what she was doing and teaching kids as little as 3 or 4 or 5 how to get food on the table for themselves and their families. People feel really good about it. People are proud to see their kids doing it. The kids are proud to share. So that really keeps me going. That's really my why, is watching young kids, teenagers, kids who haven't had this kind of food before really enjoy it and really want to share it.
And certainly, you know, each day it presents different opportunities to try new things. I just wonder, how do you get the ideas about how you are going to start a lesson, teach a lesson?
Well, we really look at what we're doing. I always look at what season it is, what we can get from our harvest. We grow hydroponic greens. We could grow hydroponic tomatoes if we wanted to, but we've got a big tower that we grow, and it's enough for the class of 14 kids to really eat from it every week. So we've got Asian lettuces that I've never seen in a grocery store, all sorts of really interesting crops that we grow indoors with water, no soil, and big lights. The kids get a kick out of it. They get to harvest. We come up with our special harvest scissors. They cut them. We decide, are we cooking spinach today? Are we eating fresh greens raw? We make our own dressings. We try different cheeses and seasonings. They've just always impressed me. Every single time I go in there, they make something better than I could have because they've got their own ideas. And that's what I love about it so much.
And I think there's also an environmental aspect to this as well, because when you're taking care of the earth and you're actually getting something out of it, I think that you're more inclined to actually care about how you treat your environment naturally.
Absolutely. I've seen my students pick up garbage outside because we went out and we tested the playground soil at their school. We wanted to see what kind of condition it was in. We compared it to compost. So it's really literally from the ground up. It was a grassroots initiative that Sonia started, and we're really going from dirt, which is soil, to a plant, to food, to sharing food, and hopefully making a better community for everyone. In addition, we've got those open lots that are now beautiful and functioning farms.
Right. And there's so much community buy-in here, because it's not only the kids, it's not only Sonia, who I've interviewed multiple times, but it's the neighbors that surround Urban Holistics that really make it.
I mean, who wouldn't want to live next to an amazing farm full of goodness, and
yeah,
people coming to the neighborhood to check it out because it's beautiful and interesting, because we've got murals over here and we've got kids playing tag in between the plants, and we've got apple trees and pear trees and things you don't always see right in the middle of the city.
And so how would you say that has benefited the neighbors in the community?
I feel like not only is it beautiful and functional, it's fun. There's events going on. There's programming. There's people in and out of the little farmhouse. It's just a house in Toledo, but we call it the farmhouse because it's across from the farm. And the energy and, dare I say, the vibe there is so fantastic. Every time you walk in, you smell the wonderful smells. There's always something cooking in the kitchen. There's healthy food everywhere. And there's just excitement and joy.
And obviously, being in the winter season, it's so much colder and a lot more difficult to get outside of the house. But spring is not too far away.
Correct. And so, we're coming up on spring, and I cannot wait to see everything that comes up from the ground for us.
Care to share a little preview of what's to come?
I think it's okay to say that we're going to be growing now. We're going to be in more than one school. Right now we've been in one charter school in Toledo. We have plans to be in two or three more as career prep programming. So hopefully we can raise the next generation of urban farmers, let children see this is a really viable option for them. We have space here, we have sun, and we have water, and that's all they need. We love these hydroponic towers that give us the chance to eat in the winter too, and in February and in March before we have things coming up. And that's fantastic, so we can all enjoy the good greens that are coming out of the city even in the winter.
Yeah, because certainly it's important to just be able to transfer those skills to other areas.
For sure. The kids are learning how to take care of things. They're learning how to plan and project what they're going to have. They're learning how to put together meals out of a few different items that maybe they wouldn't have in the past. So.
Yeah, and obviously that exploratory process, you mentioned that you kind of give them this free rein to try new things. Tell me about the times when maybe things don't go as well as expected.
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, when I started teaching in the schools, I wasn't used to the middle school age range as much. And it's a tough one for teachers. You get roasted a little bit.
I was a middle schooler once,
you know,
I can recall.
You know what it's like. I think building relationships is what every good teacher will tell you you need to do. So you start caring about your students. I'm really good at caring. I really love being around young people. And they always remind me of my own kids. So I think that if you can bring an open heart and you're culturally aware, that you are respecting traditions, that you're learning as much as you're teaching, that really lets you be a part of a community that you haven't in the past. So with my students, I used to tell them they're all my favorite students. I had 14 favorite students because I really do enjoy them all. Once I start learning about them and learning about what they care about, it really, really makes it an easy path to learning. And I again, that food, you make them food, they will like you.
I'm going to remember that. You know, and it's interesting because you are right now helping them in the part of their life that is really formative. And so what are your expectations for them down the road as adults? Some of the things they're going to take with them from this program?
Oh, that's a great question. I know a couple of our students really want to be farmers when they grow up. So whether or not they do that their entire lives, the Urban Farm does have funds to hire some of our students. So we hire them when they're 15, 16 years old with a work permit. They make really good money for learning even more and actually becoming an urban farmer. That is something they could do later in their lives, or it's just something that, of course, those skills they can transfer anywhere. Learning to be responsible, learning to start a project and finish a project, which is pretty amazing for a young person to actually plant a seed and then see what comes from it. They actually make their own products that they can also sell. So that's very, very exciting.
And really, this is one way of instilling that community responsibility, because people are going to be more so inclined to support a community when they feel like they're a part of one.
Absolutely. I think that's the most important thing, is that it is community building and that the young folks are able to be rooted here and grounded here and see what we have here for them.
Yeah. And certainly you mentioned that during the spring and summer, there are a lot of outdoor events that happen at Tatum Park. I've been down there at one of them. You see so many different people, not even just from the neighborhood, but outside of the neighborhood, that come to be a part of that. Why do you think that is?
It's really becoming a draw. My husband works in Findlay and lives in Toledo, and he makes a point to drive by the farm almost every day because he loves to see it. So I think people are impressed with what's going on, impressed with the changes that have happened pretty quickly, if you look at it in relative terms. And it's beautiful, it's fun, there's activity, and it's always different because the farm's always got something different happening.
And we often have this conversation in Toledo, as in the last few years, there's been this revitalization that's taken place downtown. One thing people are persistently wanting is that same feeling in their neighborhoods. So from the sounds of it, that revitalization for neighborhoods has to start with neighborhoods.
It's true. It's true. And I think a garden is a great way to do it, because even just walking by when you're starting out, people will say, what's this? How's this working? Is this an herb? What's over here? And it's a great conversation starter, and it really pulls people in.
And so for people who perhaps know a young person in their life who maybe could benefit from being a part of Urban Holistics or would at least like to give a class a try and learn a new skill, how do you approach them?
Well, we have everything on our website, urbanholistics.org. We do youth programming, we do after-school programming, and in-school programming. So if they're really interested, they could talk to their school about opportunities. If they can't do that, they can come see us after school. And there are a lot of summer programs that are really wonderful and valuable.
Yeah, and just lastly here, what role have the schools played in the program?
At this point, the schools have allowed us to come in and present career prep curriculum. And that's what I'm doing most of my time with my job. We are looking for more funding for that, of course. We're looking for more schools for that. And we'd just like to make the biggest impact we can in the community.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Bridget Adams, an agricultural teacher with Urban Holistics. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is all for this edition of Toledo Works, which is a part of WGTE's The Local Thread and produced in partnership with the Toledo Free Press. You can find the show online at wgte.org/ToledoWorks, where new episodes are posted Friday morning before they air in the evening here on FM 91 at 7 p.m. For now, have a great weekend.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.